You're listening to Dr. Finn Pollard and colleagues on Siren FM with Past Prologue.
The word is about, there's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
It was, of course, the great Harry Webb who said, "We're all going on a summer holiday." Well, that's not true of the Past Prologue team, or is it, Finn Pollard?
Well, we are going on to holidays in the past. Sadly, we are all, well, not sadly, because we're always happy to be on the air, but we are all still chained to our desks with the last bits of student admin and such.
Indeed. But, in case people are interested in time, this show, which is being broadcast on the last Thursday in July, is actually being recorded at the start of July. So there we are.
Yes, we're a bit temporarily confused this, this month.
But you've still got three absolutely sensational co-presenters as well, one of whom is connecting telephonically.
We do. We are joined today here in the studio by Dr. Jonathan Fitzgibbon, Dr. Kate Hill, and down the line all the way from Sheffield, Dr. Helen Smith. And we're going to start with Helen on the other end of the phone still, I hope. And I thought I'd start by asking you, Helen, what kind of holidays were people enjoying at the beginning of the 20th century?
Thanks very much, Finn. At the beginning of the 20th century, there were quite a few different types of holidays that people perhaps wouldn't be familiar with today. So, for example, very rich people were still going on what could be kind of classed as like a grand tour. So, although it wouldn't be as formal as the kind of tours that they did in the 18th century, they would travel abroad on cruise ships in lots of luxury. But for ordinary people, it was usually a trip to the seaside. And it was something very specific for working class people. It was something they used to go on holiday in what were called wakes weeks. This was something that would be familiar to anybody in an industrial town or city, right up until the end of the Second World War, really. And what this meant was certain factories, steelworks, mines closed down for a full week. And during that week, everybody from the surrounding area would go off on their holidays to places like Blackpool and Scarborough and Filey.
Why were they called wakes weeks?
That's a really interesting question, isn't it? And it goes right back to medieval times, actually, the kind of basis for that. And it was originally a religious celebration or feasts into a secular holiday, particularly in the north of England and the Midlands during the Industrial Revolution. And then I guess people just follow tradition and kept that title, even as it lost all its older connotations and just became holiday time.
So the name just sort of stuck.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
And is there, when they're on these seaside holidays, are there kind of rituals that, or sort of, are they all sort of doing the same things when they're there, sort of expectations about how they'll spend the time?
Yeah, I mean, it would be very much like uprooting the town and taking it off to a seaside place. So you would probably end up in boarding houses next door to your neighbours. So the whole streets in places like Blackpool would be like streets back at home. And people would do lots of group activities, going dancing, going down to the seafront, playing on the fairs, things like that. So it was very much a communal holiday.
And you were suggesting we might also talk about the point at which sort of paid holiday comes into this. Are the factories paying for these weeks trips at the beginning of the century, or are people paying for this out of their own pocket? And how does that then sort of transmute into what we'd be more familiar with now, where you have a certain amount of statutory leave?
Yeah, sure. So at the start of the 20th century, the factories would allow people to take unpaid holidays. So basically people would lose their wages for taking holiday and they would have to pay for them themselves. And sort of from 1905, 1906 times, people were guaranteed 12 to 15 days holiday a year, but at their own expense. So from 1911, when the Labour Party becomes a political force, there are campaigns for paid holiday, but this doesn't actually become recognised in law until 1938. So by 1938, everybody receives paid holiday, not as much as we receive now, but they do receive paid holiday. But throughout the interwar period, so from the 1920s onwards, certain factories and big companies do give paid holiday anyway, but only if you're lucky enough to be at one of those firms.
And is that sort of process in Britain happening in a sort of similar time frame to other countries, or are the British ahead or behind the curve on this?
I think broadly speaking, the British are a little bit ahead of the game here. So from what I understand, paid holidays and longer paid holidays come in much quicker in Britain than the rest of Europe and in America.
And obviously, as you were saying, through into the interwar period, there's still this tradition of the seaside holiday as perhaps the norm. At what point do we start to morph into what we might be more familiar with now, the sort of overseas break, the sort of overseas holiday?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, isn't it? Because that's the ubiquitous thing now, isn't it? That we all tend to more often go abroad for holidays. Things start to change from 1938 and into the post-war period with paid holidays, and people tend to move away from the traditional seaside holidays and tend to go to holiday camps more often. So things like Butlins are incredibly popular in the late 1940s into the 1950s. But into the 1960s, air travel and foreign holidays start becoming much cheaper. And particularly in the early 1970s onwards, package holidays, really cheap package holidays, become really available to most people. So a lot of working class people can then start to afford to go abroad. And you see this reflected in films like Carry On Abroad and the Are You Being Served comedy film, reflecting this idea that ordinary people are now starting to go abroad much more regularly.
And do you lose the community dimension of it as a result of that? Are we moving from sort of this era when the whole village is kind of the whole factory is kind of decamping to Blackpool or wherever en masse, to an era when travel is becoming a more family-based or even individual experience, do you think?
Yes, absolutely. That's a really clear trend throughout the 20th century. So as you've just said, the wakes, weeks, the seaside holidays, and particularly the holiday camps were very communal. People went on holiday with the idea that they would be going with lots of extended family, friends, and kind of having a group experience when they got there. And then the rise of travel abroad really brings with it the kind of a rise of individualism. So, as you say, people start to go on holiday with just their own families or with partners or with friends. And it becomes much more of an individual experience, I guess, more like we experience it today.
And another thing I was thinking about is there any sort of parallel in the earlier period? Obviously, one of the things that I sort of feel we're familiar with in terms of more modern, the package holiday and so on, is the kind of issue of bad behaviour while abroad. And I wonder, do you have sort of similar problems when the population of the factory is decamping to the seaside with drunkenness or violence or anything like that?
That's a really interesting question, because that's the kind of question that the authorities at the time were starting to ask as well. And some of the, shall we say, more right-wing media were starting to get worried about particularly young people going on these kind of mass holidays during the wakes weeks. And actually, mass observation, which was a social research organisation, really, that started in the 1930s and asked people to contribute to it through their own diaries, but also observed people's behaviour, sent some mass observers, so some people to go to Blackpool specifically to look out for this bad behaviour that people thought might occur. And actually, probably sadly for us as historians wanting to have a look at that information, it was all pretty tame. They didn't actually find much bad behaviour at all. So, you know, people had a drink and had a good time, but they didn't find any violence or sort of any drunken disorderly behaviour. It was just people having fun. So I guess the answer to that is I don't think this kind of notion of the Brits abroad and worries around people's behaviour was something that we could really apply to people going on holiday in this country in the interwar period.
I just want to ask you one other thing, and then before we round off this segment. Is there any sense of sort of angst around, we were talking a moment ago about that shift from sort of community to more individualised family travel. Is there any kind of similar angst around that as you were sort of saying there was on the part of the authorities about behavioural issues?
Yes, there was. So particularly from the 1950s into the 1960s, there were a whole host of cultural commentators and people like Richard Hoggart in particular, who were academics, intellectuals, writers, who were worried about the loss of working class culture. So the idea that in the post-war period, the rise of affluence, so working class people having more money, Americanization of culture, all these kinds of things they believed were chipping away at a working class consciousness, at a class culture. And they were really worried about this, that actually what they felt made being British great, to use kind of unfortunate language from the current political climate, was being challenged by this kind of move towards individualism. And in some of their writing, they did worry about this idea that actually the kind of community spirit that came from those kinds of holidays was going to be gone. But again, you know, people who were actually experiencing these things, you know, tended to be quite pleased about the fact that, you know, there were other opportunities available and, you know, opportunities to go and see the world. So there are always those two sides of the story.
Take to the sky. But till that morning, there's nothing can harm you. Yes, with daddy and mommy standing by.
Summertime.
Yeah, deep in my senses.
And the living is easy.
Oh, Betty Susan.
Fish are jumping, and the cotton is high. Oh, your daddy's rich, and your ma is good-looking.
Was Louis Armstrong and Ella Fitzgerald with Summertime. I feel we should be under a parasol in the sun sipping a cocktail, but it's lunchtime, so it's perhaps a bit early for that. Well, when we're recording this, it's lunchtime, I should say. Moving on. So we're turning now a little bit further back in time to Dr. Kate Hill, and I thought we would start by thinking, so obviously you're a 19th century British historian. How much do we see a similar picture to the one that Helen was painting in terms of the holiday experience at that time, and how much is a very different world?
Yes, thanks. I think there are a number of things that are set up in the 19th century in terms of moving towards quite sort of distinctive modern ways of enjoying yourself, if you like. But at the same time, it is different from the 20th century experience because it's largely a middle class experience that we see in the 19th century. One of the similarities, I think, is the role of technological innovation in enabling different sorts of travel. Helen talked about air travel as an important way that sort of democratized travel abroad. In the 19th century, the main item of technological innovation is the train, of course, although steamships, I think, are relevant here as well. And the train revolutionizes travel. All of these technological innovations are thought during the period to actually shrink the globe, that you can imagine going round the world, for example, around the world in 80 days. Thomas Cook, who I want to talk about a bit, he did a round the world tour, which took him 222 days. I think that was in the 1870s or 80s. So with this new technology, you can actually get places really, really relatively rapidly that you couldn't get before. And this works on a level in Britain as well. The rail network is a really important enabler of some of these seaside resorts, which go on to be big in the 20th century. Like Blackpool, for example, and so it happens in Europe as well. People are travelling much more easily across Europe, and they're going beyond Europe too. And of course, we probably want to think a little bit about the role of empire in facilitating some of those travels. Although obviously, other places that people go to are nothing to do with the British Empire, but Egypt is very important example for that. The first Thomas Cook tours to Egypt are in the late 1860s, and in the 1880s Thomas Cook helped transport British troops to Egypt as part of their kind of move into control over Egypt during that period.
So perhaps we should stay on this imperial theme for a moment that you've sort of raised. Is it the case that the travel agent in and the sort of holiday destination is following a British occupation, or is it the fact that people are starting to go there and then the British government sort of thinks that more control is needed? Or does it vary from place to place?
It does vary. I think one of the underlying mechanisms is that the changing technology enables both recreational travel and travel of all sorts of different types, including for scientific reasons. And science and empire are very closely linked. The more you know about an area, the easier it is to dominate it. Travel around India, for example, is and Australia, all of these places are. It's very hard to separate out leisure, political, military, and scientific travel. They all tend to merge together. Again, on the Thomas Cook tours, you've got people from the British Museum looking for Egyptology, as well as people from the British military, as well as people who have a purely, if you like, recreational interest.
So it's a very mixed kind of
travel.
And does that mean you get friction between, you know, if you've got a group, say, on one of these tours of these different people with different agendas for what they want out of it, do you get friction between them in terms of what the tour is doing, or does it generally work reasonably?
No, I think there's a real unity of purpose, actually, which speaks to a certain view of Britishness during the period. So, for example, one of the people on an early Thomas Cook tour of Egypt, within 10 years of them starting or so, he was just a retired businessman. But one of the things he did is he went to a fairly recent battlefield and collected shells from the battlefield, just picking up souvenirs. In other words, he was quite interested in not souvenirs of Egypt, but souvenirs of British activity in Egypt. And I think that the things that people brought home are a really interesting indicator of what they're going for. So there are those kind of things that they picked up on battlefields. They're also coming back with pressed flowers and bits of geology that they've collected, and there's quite a lot of advice by the 1880s on what to take with you in order to bring these sorts of natural products home. And again, that shows that people are equally interested in sort of scientific travel, even if they're amateurs, as they are in touristic travel.
So have you got a sort of evolution of the guidebook alongside this, or holiday advice book coming in as well?
Yes, you have. I mean, I don't know a huge amount about it in terms of looking at it over time, but some of the things you can see, Thomas Cook have their own publications. They have a periodical which starts quite early in the 19th century, and you can sort of subscribe to that. There are all sorts of increasingly segmented guidebooks, I think, including ladies' guides, which I think are a particularly interesting example because of the advice on what to wear, which is generally unbelievable. I think would be the amount of it, the weight of it, how hot these clothes. I mean, you're advised to wear layers of wool clothing, partly because it is breathable, but really it's quite it sounds awful, to be honest with you. There's stockings and everything, boots.
I presume there's also a moral dimension to that as well, that God forbid, you know, anybody show too much leg or whatever on you know, in a foreign climate, that there are sort of standards of behaviour.
Absolutely, and it's part of Britishness, I think, is to wear certain clothes, clothes and morality being and essence of person being very closely linked there, and a way of spreading civilization was to change the way people dressed.
We were sort of talking a bit with Helen about sort of moral dimensions and anxieties about travel and that kind of thing. And obviously there is a very clear, or there certainly is elements of a sort of theoretical agenda behind this, as you've been suggesting, to do with empire and ideas of Britishness and so on. Are there anxieties about this closer contact with foreign countries, that the possible impact on
I think there are interesting moral issues raised by travel, but I think that there are specific ways in which this particular class group, who are the first to travel in this way, I know that there is a grand tour before this, but the middle class group, I think, are coming with a lot of anxiety about the moral status of leisure, which the aristocracy didn't have, because that's all they did really was leisure. But the middle class have a very kind of puritanical approach to leisure. You could say that in the first half of the 19th century, they're waging war on what they see as quite unrespectable forms of leisure, such as drinking, gambling, animal sports, these kind of things. So they are very, I think, worried that if they are being self-indulgent, that might be seen as morally suspect. And I think largely the way they do that, they deal with that, is by the kind of activities they do. So again, things like botanizing is morally improving, very heavily morally improving. And you see that on middle class holidays in Britain as well. They tend to go to places which are beyond the reach of the railway if they can, so the working class don't come and fill the place up with drinking and gambling, but also so that they've got more unspoiled places to do their botanizing in. A number of middle class people really spend a lot of time in the summer collecting seaweed and things like that. As they go abroad, they go to Switzerland quite a lot. Thomas Cook takes a lot of people to Switzerland, where it's about appreciating nature. And again, they distinguish themselves not just from the working class, but from the locals. The British invent mountaineering, and they always say that the locals aren't interested in climbing these mountains, even though they often rely heavily on mountain guides from the locality. And when they even get to places like Egypt, again, there's botanizing. There is charitable work. Early tours of Cairo don't focus on historic monuments so much as visiting charitable schools set up by English women for poor children, poor Egyptian children. And from Egypt, of course, you also go to the Holy Land in a typical Thomas Cook tour, which again deals with the idea that you're being self-indulgent or morally dubious through your leisure.
Taxman's taken all my dough and left me in my stately home, blazing on a sunny afternoon. And I can't sail my yacht, he's taken everything I got. All I've got's this sunny afternoon. Save me, save me from this squeeze. I got a big fat mama trying to break me. And I love to live so pleasantly. Live this life of luxury, blazing on the sunny. Run up with my car and gone back to her mom and pop.
so pleasantly. Live this life of luxury, blazing on a sunny afternoon. In the summertime, in the summertime, in the summertime, in the summertime, in the summertime.
That was the Kinks with Sunny Afternoon. I feel we're really bringing the sunshine into the studio today. So we're again going further back in time now, and we had a brief mention there in the last segment about the sort of Puritan tendencies of the middle class travellers in the Victorian era, and we're turning now to Dr. Jonathan Fitzgibbons to think about the earlier Puritans, and who were they exactly, and what did they think about holidays?
Thanks, Lynn. So, who were the Puritans? Well, in order to explain that, we need to go back to the 16th century. We need to go back to the 1530s, to the reign of dear old Henry VIII, and his marital problems. We all know that Henry VIII famously wanted a divorce from Catherine of Aragon. When he couldn't get that, he basically tells the Pope to stuff it. I'm going to break with Rome, I'm going to set up my own church, the Church of England, of which Henry VIII becomes the head. Now, over time, the Church of England becomes increasingly Protestant. In fact, it actually becomes something of a kind of halfway house between Protestantism and Catholicism. You still have, for instance, remnants of Catholicism like bishops, like cathedrals. Now, not everyone's happy with the kind of pace of this Reformation in England. On the one hand, you've got Catholics, obviously, who don't like the idea of breaking with Rome at all. On the other hand, you've got this group called the Puritans. And they just believe that the Reformation hasn't gone far enough. You need to make the church purer, hence the name Puritan. And how they want the church to be reformed is they want to reform it according to Scripture. If it's not in the Bible, they say, it's not coming in, basically. We shouldn't, you know, the church must follow what the Bible says. And as a result of this kind of ideology, holidays become kind of top of their hit list. Because what are holidays? Well, you know, where does the word derive from? It's holy days. Holy days are holidays. They're religious festivals. So we think of, you know, holidays such as Christmas, Easter, Whitsuntide, as well as saints' days like, you know, the Feast of St. George. And they say, if you look to the Bible, there's nothing in there that says we should be celebrating these days. Okay, they say, if anything, holidays like Christmas, for instance, are very pagan. They go back to kind of Roman festivals like Saturnalia. Another reason why they kind of despise holidays, though, isn't just because they're not in the Bible. It's because of all the things that go along with holidays. You know, the things that go along with it, such as drinking. Yeah, you know, excess eating, debauchery, and sex. You know, these are things that really concern the Puritans. You know, they want moral reformation as well.
Is behaviour on these holidays as sort of morally black, as it were, as the Puritans make it out to be? Is there as much drinking and whoring going on, in a sense, as they might argue?
Yeah, you always get the sense that, you know, it's never quite as bad as they say. And also, there's also a danger that we paint too black a picture of the Puritans themselves. You know, Puritans still did like to drink. Oliver Cromwell famously really does enjoy his wine, for instance. So, you know, they're not complete killjoys, these people.
So how do they square... I mean, how do they square that? Is it just a case of you've got to drink in appropriate amounts...
Yeah,
or that only certain classes should be allowed to drink,
and also it's context as well. Context is everything. It's you. What concerns them is kind of using religion as a kind of cover for these kind of acts. You know, it's all very well to do these things, you know, in moderation in the pub, but to do them as a kind of, you know, saying that you're celebrating Christ by doing this, they find that completely, you know, abhorrent. Mm.
And apart from the sort of drinking and other aspects that we've talked about, are there other characteristics of the celebration of these holy days that we could sort of draw out, or did it depend very much on the particular saint's day or the particular festival?
I mean, they pretty much despised anything along those lines, you know, anything that could be linked to religion as a holiday. That doesn't mean that they despise leisure, though, right? And once the Puritans actually get into power during the English Civil War, they passed famously their ordinance abolishing Christmas, yeah? But at the same time, they do create a holiday once a month, a secular holiday on every second Tuesday of the month for workers. So they do appreciate that people do have to have time off, but not... You know, again, the context is everything here. You know, you've got to take it out of the religious sphere and make it secular. And if anything, the Puritans almost kind of invent the bank holiday, really.
And does that once monarchy is restored, does that sort of aspect of Cromwellian England just get swept away, or does it endure at all into the Restoration period?
I mean, you could say one of the reasons that the Restoration happens is because people miss their holidays, basically. You know, there is no real sympathy beyond the hardcore of Puritans. And I should stress that Puritanism was always a minority view in this period. A sizable minority, don't get me wrong. But, yeah, there were plenty of people who really missed their Christmas holiday. And there were even riots during the Cromwellian period, famously in Canterbury, for instance, 1648. People rioted at the attempts to ban Christmas.
And we were also talking a moment ago about their attitude to sort of leisure more broadly, and the fact that they do recognise the need of people to have leisure time. Mm. But it obviously brings us to another question. That, you know, one of the other things I think that is in the kind of, I don't know, common, or what people commonly think they know about the Puritans, is also a sort of aversion to the stage and aversion to the theatre. How true is that?
Again, as I've been stressing, context is everything, again. I mean, they did see stage plays as frivolous. They did see them as idolatrous. What they really were concerned about is that stage plays can lead people to sin. They think if people see these things being acted out on stage, they'll then try and imitate them. And you know, you can always think of interesting debates about TV today, you know, as well. Theatres themselves were often seen as dens of prostitution, of gambling as well. Interestingly, Puritans also thought that plague spread through theatres, which was true in a way, but it wasn't because of divine wrath, it was just because of contagion, you know. I've got a nice quote actually here from a preacher who describes stage plays, just to give you a flavour of, you know, what they people thought of them. So William Crashaw in 1607 describes plays as a bastard of Babylon, a daughter of error and confusion, a hellish device, the devil's own recreation, by him delivered to the heathen, from them to the papists, and now to us. You know, you can really see the sense of, you know, what's wrong with these plays. But, ironically, paradoxically, during Cromwell's reign, stage plays still do go on. But they have to be for didactic purposes. So one of the big blockbusters of the Cromwellian era is a play called The Tyranny of the Spaniards in Peru, which is an anti-Catholic play, which is completely fine. It's all the kind of frivolous, jolly play that they can't cope with, you know, the ones that show debauchery on stage. But they still do like plays, and they do like music as well. And again, the play I've just alluded to is actually a very early form of opera, actually. It was set to music. So some forms of art do flourish under Puritan rule, whereas others don't. And again, it's just context is everything. Yeah.
And does the audience hold up for that? You know, for these more didactic... Do we have any knowledge about whether the audience holds up for the more didactic productions?
Well, I think people just, you know, they just go for what's the... You know, anything's better than nothing. You know, think back to the days of TV when you only had one channel, everybody watched that one channel, you know. So, given there's no choice, people do still go to these, and it just, you know, it shows that there is still a demand there for plays. And also, plays do go on covertly as well, and you know, you do get cases of the Cromwellian soldiers storming in and breaking up plays that are being performed privately in noblemen's houses, for instance.
Put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington. Don't put your daughter on the stage. The profession is overcrowded, and the struggle's pretty tough. And admitting the fact she's burning to act, that isn't quite enough. She has nice hands to give the wretched girl her due, but don't you think her bust is too developed for her age? I repeat, Mrs. Worthington, sweet Mrs. Worthington, don't put your daughter on the stage. Regarding yours, dear Mrs. Worthington, of Wednesday the 23rd, although your baby may be keen on a stage career, how can I make it clear this is not a good idea for her to hope, dear Mrs. Worthington, is on the face of it absurd. Her personality is not in reality exciting enough, inviting enough for this particular sphere. Don't put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington. Don't put your daughter on the stage. She's a bit of an ugly duckling, you must honestly confess, and the width of her seat would surely defeat her chances of success. It's a loud voice, and though it's not exactly flat, she'll need a little more than that to earn a living wage. On my knees, Mrs. Worthington, please, Mrs. Worthington, don't put your daughter on the stage. Don't put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington, don't put your daughter on the stage. Though they said at the School of Acting she was lovely as Peer Gynt, I'm afraid on the whole an ingenue role would emphasize her squint. She's a big girl, and though her teeth are fairly good, she's not the type I ever would be eager to engage. No more butts, Mrs. Worthington, nuts, Mrs. Worthington, don't put your daughter on the stage.
That was Noel Coward with Don't Put Your Daughter on the Stage. Possibly the Puritans could have adopted it as a marching anthem, or at least Don't Put Your Daughter on the Stage in the Wrong Play would probably be the might be the way of looking at it. So I think one of the things that was coming out of both the Victorian and the early modern period was this question of the need to control what people are doing when they're in their leisure time. And to what extent do either of you think that real, is effective control achieved over individual practice? Is effective control achieved over the population at large? Or are these sort of, is this sort of an aspirational thing on the part of, as it were, sort of the authorities, that in practice actually, individual behaviour can vary quite a bit from the norm, even if it's varying, I suppose, behind closed doors.
I think for the 19th and going into the 20th century as well, it is very hard, and it's increasingly hard to control leisure, partly because of, as I say, these technological developments, the fact that people have increasing amounts of disposable income, and that puts into play a very opposed force to the kind of top-down control, which is the commercial imperative to make money out of these people who want to spend money on their leisure. And you see that very much in Blackpool, where there's a lot of concern about the way in which it develops, that it's too commercial, that it's too tacky, essentially, because there is still a middle-class component to people going to Blackpool, and they're not really happy. So there are attempts to control the way in which businesses develop in Blackpool, but they're by and large unsuccessful because people are trying to get around them, because they can see that there is money to be made out of these vast quantities of people who are arriving in Blackpool. And I think in many ways the 19th to the 20th century sees the kind of the rise of the commercial element overrunning that equal desire to try and turn leisure into something that's under the control of a small group of people, if you like.
I suppose in the 17th century, I mean, the state is still very unsophisticated this time. I mean, this isn't a police state. I mean, it's all very well making laws against holidays, against, you know, these leisure activities, but how do you enforce them? You know, you need people who are cooperative in the kind of localities to make sure that the alehouses stay closed, for instance, you know, to make sure that people don't celebrate Christmas. And we even get a brief period in the during Cromwell's reign where we have direct military rule in England, the infamous rule of the major generals. So, but even that all that was 12 generals divided the country up among them and kind of toured all the counties, making sure that these regulations were enforced. Now, it all works very well in practice when they're there. People, you know, nod their heads and say, yes, we're going to close the alehouses, we're banning Christmas. But as soon as these people move on, the alehouses reopen, you know, people still celebrate Christmas. So, you know, it's almost as if they feel, the Puritans feel they have to make the effort, and to the best of their conscience, they are doing these things, but, you know, whether they can actually convince the people to do them, that's the other thing. And time and again, it seems that they just can't. And as we've already said, you know, the Restoration is the kind of ultimate outpouring of hatred for this kind of godly rule.
Is there anywhere in the country where you have a sustained bureaucracy that can maintain a kind of constant watch of this? I mean, I imagine that possibly London might be exceptional, but I don't.
I mean, London, definitely, it's easier to keep control because you've got a large proportion of the army there. Interestingly, it's easier to do these things in Scotland as well because you've got more of a kind of puritanical ethos in Scotland. You've got the Presbyterian Kirk there is very tough in the communities in enforcing these things already. But yeah, it tends to be the further one gets from London, the harder it is to enforce these things. And you tend to find that the strongholds of royalism are furthest away from London, such as Yorkshire and Wales, for instance.
Another thing I was, which is sort of slightly rather tangential to this, but another thing I was thinking about that we were talking about early on in the programme was this beginnings of moves into the seaside, and we were talking about the development of Blackpool just then. And it occurred to me to ask then, and we didn't sort of slot it in, what are the sort of reasons behind this sort of trend of going to the seaside in the first place? Are we able to say anything about that?
And people have liked going to the seaside for a long time, and the first visits to Blackpool predate the train, and people are walking from Manchester to Blackpool in order to swim in the sea. So I think that's there already. What you see from the early 19th century is the sea starting to overtake the spa as a source of health. So somewhere like Scarborough has got it all because it's a spa town with the seaside. But in many ways, the sort of the Georgian interest in spas wanes a bit, and the sea comes to be seen as a very healthy place to be. It's the air above the sea, so you don't have to get in the sea. You can walk out on it, which explains piers, essentially. The thing about piers is if you walk out over the sea, you get the sea air and you get the health benefits from that. Bathing is important as well, but again, it's interesting how much bathing is facilitated by other changes, which allow suitable bathing costumes to be developed. They're not wildly technical developments, but nevertheless, it's a kind of what is the equipment we need in order to do this, and it's not there to start with, and it develops quite rapidly in the course of the 19th century, so you get to the point where you can even have mixed gender beaches by the end because the propriety is there, whereas before that they are segregated. So the seaside is tremendously important, but as I say, seaside botany is huge in the 19th century, absolutely huge. So much popular publishing aimed at women and children is based on the fact that when you go to the seaside, you will collect shells, seaweed. There's a big fad for having seawater aquaria back home so that you collect the material when you're on holiday and you bring it home with you and you have your little set of marine organisms. And it's quite hard to keep seawater marine organisms alive, but people are putting a tremendous amount of energy into that. And that's also technical developments in terms of aquaria that help them do that.
Thank you.
That was Madonna with Holiday. And we're going to move to a final question. And I thought we would play a game of getting in the blue box and going back in time. And I would ask you both, if you were transported back to your respective periods, what would be your preferred choice of holiday or holy day activity? Who would like to first?
I've got furthest to go in back in time, I suppose.
Warp.
Yeah. Obviously, you can't really travel that much in the 17th. I mean, one of the things we just, you know, touched on travel, you don't travel that far in the 17th century. You can only go as far as a horse can take you, really. Maybe I'd go along to Bath, though, or Buxton, and go and take the waters, which was, a popular pastime then. Maybe read a little Miltonian poetry in the spa. That might be a nice way to spend a 17th century holiday, I think.
Is that, just very briefly, is that are you there also to be seen in Bath at that time?
I mean,
that's already in vogue.
Yeah, already starting, and it's only the upper classes, really. I mean, I'm imagining myself as the upper classes here, but it's only the upper classes who can afford to spend the time in Bath taking the waters.
What about you, Kate?
I think that I would go for a nice middle-class British holiday in the second half of the 19th century, and I would either go to Tenby, which I think I've already said was a kind of hotbed of people like George Eliot went there, and it was beyond the reach of the railway. That was an important thing, that you could get as far as Cardiff and possibly Swansea, but from there it was quite exclusive. And the other possibility, which is very similar in many ways, is Ilfracombe, which has still got wonderful bathing areas that you can only access through a tunnel. So this was proprietorial seaside bathing. You had to pay to get a ticket to enter the tunnel to come out where the bathing places were. And I do love the idea of this very ritualised sort of sea bathing. I mean, it must have been freezing. I'm not good with cold water, it has to be said. But I think there'll be plenty to look at, even if I didn't actually venture into the water. And again, there's a huge 19th century tradition of collecting marine biology, botany, and things like that in Ilfracombe. So both of those places, I think, had that kind of quite romantic attitude to the sea as a kind of wonderful solution to all of life's problems.
So, thank you both very much. I'm having visions of all sorts of holiday opportunities. I'm realising also we've managed to get through all the way through the programme and not discuss once the possibility that the sun might not be shining in any of these places, and it might be your classic British summer of pouring rain and staring out at it from inside the holiday cottage, but we won't go there. So I'd like to wrap up for today by saying thank you as ever to all my fellow panellists, Helen Smith joining us down the line from Sheffield, Jonathan Fitzgibbons and Kate Hill here with me in the studio. Thank you also, as always, to my producer, Alex Lefchuk, who keeps us on the air and sorts out all the technical side of things. I am Dr. Finn Pollard, and Past Prologue will be back with you once again in about a month's time. Thanks for listening.
The newspapers shout, a new style is growing, but it don't know if it's coming or going. There is fashion, there is fat, some is good, some is bad, and the joke